Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Real Sports Talk Radio, courtesy of BackSportsPage.com.
Wow, our studio team is really blowing it. This is foul territory. Welcome. Randy Kelly, my man. Lunch talk coming up, big guy. Sorry, I'm got a little modern.
Cut the top off, call it Amber Rose. Just bought a big body, kind of paint the towel. Known to act a donkey on the camel toe. Then take the camel toe and turn it into casserole. Two chain talking on the flex phone. Poof, just like that, the whole check gun. Former quadrupedic, I was slapped down. So many chains on it, look like my nigga gown. My girl came through and bought an extra body. Now that's an after party for the where they send shots, then we send them back. A half $1 million worth of crack money.
That's a lot of crack money. Welcome to Foul That's Territory, ladies and gentlemen. Coming to you live on Blog Talk Radio. We're sponsored by SidelinesApp.com and BackSportsPage.com. It's your co-host, Asa Beal, here with Carson on a lovely afternoon. Usually we say evening, but it feels like afternoon because we got all this sunlight going on out here on the West Coast. What's up, Carson?
Not too much. You know, I think daylight savings time got all of us. And that, you know, with that intro, you know, April Fool's Day has come a little bit early this year. But here in Atlanta, everything is good. The weather, you know, not the greatest. But as spring progresses or as we move closer to spring, looking forward to some nice days. Maybe you guys can send us some good weather from California.
I'm going to pack up and overnight it to you. Soon, it'll be not just good weather descending on San Francisco, but it will be the finals. First, obviously, the semifinals, but the semifinals and finals of the World Baseball Classic, which is in the second round right now. It's been a really exciting tournament and has some European flavor with Italy. Though they're on the brink of elimination, they are winning so far tonight, up 3-0 over Puerto Rico, a.k.a. the 51st state, and the Netherlands making a surprise entrance all the way to the finals, led by current and former Braves alike. This has been a really fun WBC. It's only the third one ever. But, Carson, it feels like there's some momentum building. You know, it feels like people are starting to care a little bit more about this tournament, and we knew it would take a while, but do you feel the same way?
I do. I think that, like you said, the teams that have emerged to become contenders, or at least, like you said, Italy, you know, making it to the second round, making it to elimination play, and actually, you know, holding their own, you know, right now up on Puerto Rico, does a lot. You know, and, you know, I think I heard something on the broadcast that, you know, after the Netherlands advanced last year, I mean, last tournament, you know, they didn't win it. But they got far enough that, you know, they spent, you know, some of their government spent like $1 million in a new baseball complex in the Netherlands. And, you know, that sort of involvement sort of helps teams and countries get involved. And I think as we, you know, move on and the tournaments progress and get more developed, you know, teams that, like you said, you know, aren't historically baseball powerhouses come to fruition. The game sort of spreads and it gets more competitive. So I'm definitely having a great time, you know, watching the tournament this year.
Are you crushed that your communist brothers in Cuba have been eliminated?
Yeah, my brethren, they you know, I was very crushed to be honest. I watched as much as the elimination game when they ended up losing to the Netherlands as I could before going to work in the morning. You know, I think, you know, the game started like at 6 a.m. And when I left the house, you know, Cuba was down 4-0. They ride back to even it up at 6-6. You know, only lose 7-6. I was pretty disappointed. But like you said, Asa, I mean, the Netherlands is a squad. They have a really good team, and I think that they're going to, you know, really raise some eyebrows moving forward. But, I mean, they beat Japan, which I think was pretty big. And Japan, I'm guessing, had an off year. You know, they also had their own struggles. They beat a Japan team that they lost to, you know, back in the first WBC. But, I mean, I think the team that they have this year is decent. But I don't think that it stacks up, you know, comparatively to the team that, you know, the Dominican has, for example, this year, who are just, you know, tearing through people left and right. But definitely sad, you know, the Cubans are out, but got something to look forward to in the next WBC.
Yeah, and everybody talks about, I mean, obviously I'm excited for the U.S. matchup with Dominican, and according to every pundit worth his salt, those are the two best teams on paper, and everybody talks about the Dominican lineup, and the U.S. lineup is just as loaded, even though maybe doesn't have that top end talent. There's just all-stars across the board. But it's Japan, who's the two-time defending champion. It's Japan who is the team to beat. And though, you know, all of their stars, all those Japanese stars that are the name value people have come across to play in the U.S., and a lot of those guys don't play for the national team anymore, they're the team to beat. And I just thought it was an interesting correlation, you know, with the timing and the holy things that are going on right now, especially over in the smallest country on earth, the Vatican City. Really, Japan, the only, in my quick estimation in my head, the only non-Christian nation that is still left in the WBC, maybe the only one that started in it, aside from the other Asian teams. And I'm just looking for those Christ-loving nations to feel the boost of the new Pope, because Pope Francis has been chosen a archbishop from Argentina, I believe.
Argentina. And,
you know, not only a pope, but a Spanish-speaking pope. I look for some boost to all of the good God-fearing WBC teams as they quest to take down Japan, finally.
That's definitely true. You know, like you said, added to that, Ace of the first pope from the Latin American region. So look for, you know, the DR especially. Get a boost from that. You know, Puerto Rico, I guess you consider, you know, that a Latin American country as well, or a territory. But, yeah, definitely huge news about the Pope, and we'll see how it affects play in the World Baseball Classic.
Absolutely. And speaking of the Pope and other things that are really serious, let's get to Tweet Child of Mine, our most playful segment of foul territory.
She's got a smile that, it seems to me, reminds me of childhood memories, where everything was as fresh as a bright blue sky.
All right, Tommy, you're the oldest. I'm counting on you. Come on.
She's got eyes of the bluest sky, as if they thought of rain.
That's right, everybody. Tweet Child of Mine, Tweet of the Week. I'm going to start us off talking about a tweet from Rob Delaney, something new and different for me.
Gotta be.
Something new and different for me, and it's topical. Hey, Conclave, you fucked up last time. If you don't pick Wesley Snipes this time, we'll know you're not truly sorry. End quote. And
it's relevant, man.
It is.
It's the news of the hour.
It is. And while sometimes it feels like our generation's religion is technology and being just constantly aware of everything going on the internet, it's funny to watch a situation like this evolve in today's world, because it permeates everything you look at, what anything you're reading on the computer, anything you hear or see on television. And, you know, in every sector, you turn on any network today and they're going to be making Pope jokes. And it's so funny. It cracks me up. And I don't think it's what the Cardinals have in mind when they have this sacred ritual, which turns into just comedy for America. But hey, it happens. What you got for us, Carson?
I got a bio blast from Trey Wingo, who did some investigative work. And he tweeted about a guy that we've talked about in the show multiple times, Barkevious Mingo. He has a very unique name. And he tweeted saying that Barkevious Mingo has two brothers, one Hugh the Third, and another Hugh-tavious. I think it's a pretty unique set of names growing up in the Mingo household with Barkevious, Hugh the Third, and Hugh-tavious. All in one house, definitely a unique mix of names.
So Q-tavious, I would have to imagine, is the best looking one. I mean,
Q-tavious,
he doesn't have the looks to back it up. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with that logic. That makes all the sense in the world to me.
Maybe he has a sister, Butavious.
He might. Trey Wingo did not delve that far, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I like Trey Wingo. He's kind of a goob, but
he is. He has some unique tweets, and you know, very informative, and most of them pretty socially relevant. So
yeah, he's keeping it up to date. We're going to get you guys up to date with the National Football League. We're not going to waste any more time because I know you're itching for the news. And the NFL does this funny thing where the season ends and then there's this big silent period where you can't do anything, you can't talk to anybody, and then they unleash free agency on you right away, and then within about another month, the draft is on. They really hit you hard, blindside you after a couple months of no football news. And the dam has really broken through these last few days. So we're just going to start at the top, and that's what I deem most relevant because I'm the dark overlord of this show. So you're rolling with me, and that is Wes Welker has decided to leave the Patriots and join the Broncos. He earned his right to be a free agent. He thought about it. And he's going to the Broncos, and not for a terrible amount of money. I believe it is a two-year, $12 million pact in total. Certainly not chump change, but not the salary of a number one receiver of a franchise player. But this undoubtedly makes the Broncos even more dangerous and weakens the Patriots a little bit. Carson, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like most fans, I think that we realize the importance that Wes Welker had on those Patriots teams, and I think that when you look at him and the way he fits in this Broncos system, you know, off the bat, you can tell that he's going to be a good fit, especially with the offense that they ran last year and Peyton Manning and the skills that he brings to the table, you know, at the quarterback position. Asa, you commented on, you know, the amount of money he's making, $6 million a year, like you said, that's not terribly a lot, and I think that he probably could have gotten that money with New England. It is pretty interesting to see that he ended up, you know, not staying with New England and going, you know, to Denver. I think Asa's fight has something to do with it, just in the fact that towards the end of his career in New England, you know, he had gotten some verbal spats with you know, Bill Belichick, and I felt like he felt a bit disrespected not getting a long-term deal, and I think that, you know, the Broncos are a contender. If you look at, you know, things that they've done so far with Peyton Manning at the helm. So definitely an interesting move, choosing to go for that amount of money. But when you look at it from the football perspective, I think it's a great move both for him and the Broncos. I think that when you look at a guy like Stokely, you got to feel like Wes Welker is going to end up replacing him as an inside slot guy, slot receiver. You know, a guy who his career had been dead for some years, you know, comes back with Peyton Manning and just has a revival just out of nowhere. So I think Wes Welker, a guy who's had a lot more success lately, he fits more seamlessly into that system, and he's going to have an impact off of that. So
yeah.
I'm really excited about that offense and, you know, what they have to offer, especially with Wes Welker playing that slot role.
Well, to your point of why he made that move and, you know, why he moved on, I definitely agree with you. I think that personal matters were as important as anything on the professional side. you know, I mean, a mix of that, you know, specifically dealing with Belichick and just, you know, maybe not feeling like he was getting the love, maybe feeling like, well, why didn't you just make me a nice long-term offer that, you know, let me know I was worth it. But I do think the Patriots will be able to replace him in some ways. They already made the move for Amendola, which we'll get to in a little bit. But I think the only way he makes that move is to another really good situation. Even given all the personal stuff, I think the only way he makes that move is to a team like the Broncos, like you said, a Super Bowl contender with the next best thing at quarterback, Peyton Manning, who, you know, has been right there with Tom Brady his entire career as the best quarterback in the NFL, had a horrific injury, had crazy neck surgery, and still is on top of his game, you know, even just 1 year removed from that this past season. So I think the only way he makes that move is to a team like the Broncos. The Broncos were the happy recipient of Welker. It almost feels like overkill, but with the amount that Peyton can run the no huddle, that he can spread those guys out and just direct them all over the field, it's terrifying. So Welker joins, those of you who aren't intimately familiar with the Broncos roster, he joins Demaryius Thomas and Eric Decker on the outside, both really talented receivers, both 80-plus catch guys last year. They have some good, if not great, tight ends there that Manning likes to mix and match. Jacob Tammy and Joel Dreesen come to mind, although I believe there's another who's even in the rotation. And so Welker's going to be in the slot. Now, Carson, are there going to be enough balls to go around? I mean, who's going to be Manning's favorite target when he has these three incredible receivers and Welker, who's essentially the ultimate safety blanket?
And it's, you know, the last phrase you said is safety blanket. And I think that Peyton Manning is meticulous. He is well known and revered for taking what defenses offer. And I think that with Wes Welker at the helm, him playing a slot position, you know, he'll get a lot of balls his way because the defense will dictate it that way. Or like you said, there'll be check downs. There'll be safe throws that Peyton can make that, you know, Welker can take, you know, for longer yards after the catch. You know, he does have ability and quickness to do that. That being said, you know, I think that it's going to open up the offense tremendously for deep balls down the field to both Eric Decker and my man Bebe Thomas. When you have to concentrate on a guy like Wes Welker, you know, on underneath routes, he takes guys out of the scenario, out of the equation. If you want to be able to play, you know, seven in the box, you need to commit a strong safety to check Wes Welker in the slot because, you know, frankly, the linebacker couldn't do it. And when that happens, that sets up one-on-one opportunities on the outside for Bebe Thomas and Decker, you know, on the other side. So I think that Wes Welker is going to catch a fair amount of balls. I think he's going to do his damage across the middle and underneath, and he's going to extend drives, and he's going to be able to, you know, help the Broncos have more plays on offense to begin with, which in turn is going to give more opportunities to Bebe and the guys on the outside. So I think, as a guy who has Bebe in my fantasy league, you know, most importantly, and the guy who will keep him next year, I think that he's going to flourish with Wes Welker at the helm because it's going to take a lot of pressure off of him. And if you have a guy that can extend drives like Wes Welker, that's more opportunities for the rest of the guys on the team, opportunities you would have had, you know, with Stokely playing that position. So I'm definitely excited about what he can bring to the team. And I think that, you know, he's just going to help the offense overall.
But don't you think there's a chance that Thomas turns into a guy who, instead of 80 catches, is getting more like 60-something catches, still with a ton of yards and touchdowns, but not more of a number two option, really, in fantasy, if we're being frank about it, than a number one?
And I can see that. And I think that Bebe is not a guy who, like, you know, he's not going to go out and catch 10 balls a game like a Wes Welker would. I agree with that. So his catch numbers might not be the greatest. But I think with an improved offense, when you're running more plays, that's more opportunities. And I think that sort of makes up for some of it, you know, some of the targets that'll make up, you know, Wes Welker being able to extend drives and create more plays for the offense. But in terms of, I mean, yards yards and touchdowns. I think that, you know, that's going to grow up dramatically. And I think that catch, like you said, might be something to wait on. But in terms of fantasy, I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't want a guy that has, you know, 60, 70 catches a year with 16 touchdowns, over 1,000 yards. I don't know how that would be a number two option for a guy that might catch, you know, 100 balls, you know, 1,200 yards and 4 touchdowns, 6 touchdowns. So, you know, I think he's going to be a number one option regardless, and I think Wes Welker does it even, like, cements him more so in the number one position.
Yeah, and they don't really have a running game, or at least not a consistent one. I mean, Knowshon has been good when he's been healthy, so they need to throw it. And, you know, with guys like Welker, they're able to generate what we call extensions of the running game, just short, quick pass plays that Manning is, you know, among the best at and always has been. So, you know, it's hard to say. You know, I'm not convinced that there will be a huge drop-off in the numbers of either Thomas or Decker, but I think fantasy wisdom just kind of dictates that, you know, the targets being split that much that they'll take a hit in value. But maybe that's, you know, if you really like Thomas, then maybe that helps you because you can get him a little later or for a little bit less money in an auction. However, Manning has shown the ability, as he did back in his 49-touchdown season, to throw double-digit touchdowns to three different receivers. So maybe he goes for round two of that, which would be just incredible. And speaking of Peyton Manning, he's on my fantasy team, and he's also a fifth-round pick. So I'm keeping him as a fifth-round pick, adds Wes Welker to that mix, and I'm going to have to decide every week between Peyton and RG3. It's going to be a tough year for me next year, real tough.
That's. I mean, it's a great problem to have. I don't doubt that. And just one more, note on the Welker addition. You know, I referenced today via Twitter when David Ettinger and Travis Jones tried to take shots at the throne about the year Tom Brady, you know, the record-setting year they had in 07. You know, Wes Welker had 124 catches, which is an extremely high amount of catches, and Randy Moss caught 23 touchdowns. So it's not going to be, you know, either or. I feel like I think both of these guys can flourish.
Yeah, I think you're right. Even though I was arguing against you, that's how convincing Carson Fultz is. Ladies and gentlemen, he goes by Carson Day on Facebook. Look him up if you're a potential employer. Let's talk about the Patriots side of it. Because we covered the Broncos side pretty good, and it's nothing but a positive for them. The Patriots, on the other hand, lose one of the most durable, most reliable guys on the team. He's been there for 6 seasons. In 5 of 6 seasons, he's had 111 or more catches. The only season where he didn't, he only played about 11 games that year. So, dude is a beast. They snagged him from Miami, basically made him what he was. And he was Tom Brady's security blanket, but that's not all that he was. He's much more than that. He is small, but he is still an athletic freak and just an incredible savvy at finding creases in the defense and obviously great ball receiving abilities. And that's not dirty at all. And so they replaced him with Danny Amendola, who is in a similar mold, not necessarily as talented a guy, but also a guy who's been in a bit of a rough system in St. Louis. They haven't had a ton of continuity there during his career. So do you think Amendola can step in and give them an approximation of Wes Welker?
I mean, I personally think that, I mean, I don't want to go on a limb and say that, yeah, he's going to fit in. He's going to be, you know, Wes Welker 2.0 from day one. But I think that he has the potential to do so. I think he came on strong last year, and he did some things, you know, for St. Louis that I think were pretty impressive. He struggled with injuries at some points during the season, but just in limited action, you know, he did have some pretty productive games, you know, for St. Louis and a team that struggled, frankly, offensively. And, you know, he's in sort of the same mold, you know, 5'11", 188. Actually went to Texas Tech, same school that Wes Welker played at. So I think that, you know, if it's going to be any system, you know, it's going to be, you know, the path system. If you look at Wes Welker before he came to the Patriots, you know, he was a third option, a guy that really wasn't, you know, involved too highly in the offense at Miami. And then he comes to the Patriots and becomes a star. So it kind of looks like it's too good to be true, but I think Danny Amendola has some of the same skill set that allowed him to play a similar role.
I agree. And, you know, they still are probably going to look at another guy because they still need a deep threat, essentially. But Brady manages whatever the situation is. Guys miss chunks of time. He still gets it done. I mean, the dude is a machine. And they're going to have Gronk and Hernandez ideally healthy for the majority of next season, unless both of them are really injury-prone players, in which case there's a bigger problem. But having those guys together and just on the field at the same time at full strength is ridiculous. And maybe if you have that and you have that help combined with Amendola doing his best at the slot, which I think can be pretty good, you know, you probably make up for the small drop-off, you know, from losing Welker. So it's still a team to be feared. It definitely is. But as I posted earlier today on the number one site to discuss your favorite sports teams and players, Sidelines, sidelinesapp.com, as I posted earlier today on Sidelines, I think maybe this pushes Denver ahead of New England as the favorite going into next year. And it's funny that the team that won the Super Bowl isn't even in that conversation, but, you know, Baltimore, as we've seen, has essentially dismantled their team.
Yeah, and you know, the moves that they've made are definitely interesting to say the least, but I guess something has to happen when you give, you know, Joe Flacco that type of contract, and cuts had to be made in certain places. But, I mean, definitely getting rid of, you know, Kruger, getting rid of Bolden, the team, you know, you beat in the Super Bowl. Definitely some questionable moves there. And, you know, like you said, it is kind of hard to conceive a team winning the Super Bowl and not being favored to defend a title the next year. But when you make off-season moves like that, you know, you sort of think twice about how you evaluate their chances to have success, especially in the postseason.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was listening to two old knuckleheads on a little show called PTI earlier today talk about that same topic, and they were both quick to give Ozzie Newsome the benefit of the doubt. And when I really think about it and when I look back at the record of the Baltimore Ravens franchise, which is a very young franchise, they have had incredible amount of success, especially at drafting and developing talent. And it's kind of in that you almost have to give them the benefit of the doubt, because all these stars that have come up for them, especially the stalwarts in that defense over the years, Lewis, Suggs, you know, almost all those guys were guys they drafted and developed. Their first draft pick ever was Jonathan Ogden, one of the best left tackles ever to play the game. They just have a knack for it. And while Ellerbe is a nice player and, you know, Kruger maybe is the most talented of all of the ones that they lost, you know, they're guys that are replaceable and not easily replaceable. But Bolden is, you know, he's getting up there. He's probably 35 by now. You know, maybe they think they can find a solid enough possession receiver to fill in for him, and it's not ideal. I just hope that Joe Flacco doesn't get blamed for this, because people are going to look at him and say, hey, Joe, you took all the fucking money in the bank. Now we have none left for the rest of the squad to fill out the roster.
No, I mean, that's a very good point. And, you know, like you said, in their young career, they've definitely drafted guys. You know, Ray Lewis, Jonathan Ogden, Suggs, you know, Ed Reed. And the guys have flourished, especially on the defensive side of the ball. And I guess, you know, they're just going to have to hope that you know, that sort of trend continues. You know, being able to unload and develop guys like that. And all, along the same lines, so when you look at a team like Pittsburgh, who you know, came up short of the sort of general public's expectations last year, and what they've done unloading, you know, they cut, you know, Willie Colon, you know, let Mike Wallace go, get rid of Jerome Harrison, a lot of guys, a lot of staples for that team are no longer going to be on that team. And you sort of have to wonder how they're going to go about replacing these guys on an aging team that hasn't really lived up to the expectations for the past couple seasons.
Yeah. The Steelers, it's hard to know exactly what the direction is going to be. I mean, you know, my instinct is to trust that defense and the defensive mind, LeBeau, that they have running it. But, yeah, it's hard to say. And there's definitely been – the last few years, they really haven't been that hard-nosed Pittsburgh team that we all – that you know, those characteristics that we always associate with the Steelers, the Steel Curtain, and even, you know, in years recently during their Super Bowl, their first Super Bowl run in the 2000s with that, you know, incredibly loaded defense. And you're right. It's interesting to see, you know, where those moves are going to go and what they're going to do. And they let Mike Wallace go. And I frankly think it's kind of ridiculous that he's getting paid $60 million. I don't think he's that good. But still, you got to replace him. That's a deep threat. You have other talented receivers. But, you know, you let him go and then you re-sign both Dwyer and Redman. What are you doing? I mean, I don't know about that. Maybe one of those two running backs, but both of them seems like a waste. Neither of them seem like a starter to me necessarily.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, and you got a guy like Mendenhall who's also a free agent. You have to think about him. And
he went to the Cardinals today.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, no, that was
already
breaking.
He's already been taken out of scenario. And yeah, I mean, like you said, I guess, you know, Redman and Dwyer. I didn't like, you know, watching them last year, I didn't like that they were both bigger physical backs. I felt like when you watch those guys, they ran powerfully, but they sort of ran in slow motion. So, you know, there wasn't too much explosion at the hole. But I think a guy like Mendenhall sort of brought that explosion, but like you said, he was injury prone. But it's going to be interesting to see, you know, they'll let Chris Rainey go, a guy that they look to sort of bring a spark to their offense and special teams. Who's no longer going to be there as well. The direction of this team, I think, is sort of suspect. And when guys sort of reach a peak and get older, you have to sort of look at how you can overhaul things without taking too much of a loss, you know, in the win-loss column and your chances to make the playoffs the next season.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you're building a team in the NFL, You're looking to win your division. I think that's really the number one consideration, because a division win still gets you a home playoff game. And the Dolphins added Mike Wallace because they need to be able to put up points if they're ever going to compete with the New England Patriots. They're going to have to stretch the field just like the Patriots can do. You got to fight fire with fire in today's NFL. And Mike Wallace is a guy who's had some up and downs in his career. He had one really dominant season, not dominant, but just really good season. And last year faded a little bit. His health was suspect. The wide receiver rotation that the Steelers used was a little bit perplexing at times. He's gone over 1,000 yards twice in his career. He had 10 touchdowns back in 2010, only 836 yards last year, though. And he did play 15 of 16 games. So the Dolphins give him $60 million. I think that's way too high, but maybe they just had to make this move because they had to get someone.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially sort of looking at the example of the NFC South. When you look at the teams and the way that they're set up, the same sort of set the mold and a lot of teams have done. You know, a lot to sort of match them, you know, the talent that they had on both sides of the ball. But like you said, the $60 million is a heck of a lot, and especially for a guy that sort of came out of nowhere his rookie year, a guy that sort of gave that vertical threat to the Steelers, a guy that wasn't really high regarded coming out of Ole Miss. But, you know, like you said, I feel like it's a niche market, and no matter what Miami does outside of the division, you know, they're still playing New England twice a year. And like you said, you have to be able to put points on the board if you're going to expect to stick with them. So the move is sort of suspect, and Philbin, you know, team is yet, with Tannehill playing, you know, at the quarterback position. So we'll see if him and Tannehill can build a rapport, and maybe it'll help him out in his second year to get acquainted with the offense and make some plays.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the Dolphins a little bit. That's not really a team we talk about very much, but the first thing that came to my mind today when I saw that Mike Wallace was going there, and also that Danelle Ellerbe was going there, one of those Ravens who departed Baltimore, and I think a really talented guy, a really solid linebacker who can cover, who can play the run, just a little bowling ball running in there. But Miami's got the Miami factor, and I think it started when LeBron went there, and not really Chris Bosh at all, just LeBron going. Hello. All right, that was weird. I don't know what happened there. I'm not sure when we cut out, so I'm just going to jump back in right where I was a few minutes ago talking about the Dolphins and the fact that they might be able to compete for an AFC wild card the next 2 years if Tannehill makes the strides that they expect him to. Hey, Carson, I'm not sure what happened there. What was the last thing you heard me talking about? Because I just kept going. I didn't realize that we had been disconnected.
So talking about Ellerbe making moves to the Finns.
Okay, cool. Well, so the larger point that I was leading up to, and that I want to ask you about, is that it seems to me the Dolphins might be able to compete, if not for that division crown, at least for an AFC wildcard spot in the years to come, if Tannehill can make the strides that they expect him to, and that they hope guys like Wallace will help him to. Do you think that's feasible at all, or is this a total pipe dream?
If you put it like that in terms of if you know his development is sort of contingent, or they're making the playoffs is contingent on his development, I think that hypothetically that's a good way to look at it. But I just think that Tannehill's, I wasn't really sold on the guy coming out of college, but I mean, you look at, you know, the offensive line that was led by, you know, Marquise Pouncey. He's a solid guy, and you add Mike Wallace to that team, a defense who needs some help in the secondary. But like you said, adding Ellerbe to that core is definitely helpful. And I think a lot of it, too, depends on, in terms of winning the division, the Bills remaining to be bad and also the Jets to continue to struggle. So I think any combination of those two things could help them get on top. But just looking at the team, sort of how it plays out right now, I'm not sure if Tannehill can lead them to that point. But, you know, if he does develop into a quarterback that can be relied on to throw the ball, you know, 30-plus times a game, and the defense does get a little bit better, I think that they would be contending for a wild card spot.
Yeah. And it's clear that the Dolphins made a bit of a philosophical change because they added a deep threat receiver, but they lost their leading rusher. And by lost, I mean Detroit swooped in and gave Reggie Bush $40 million, I believe is how much they gave him. And that seems like a lot to me. The Lions are kind of a mess, to be honest. I mean, I think there's a ton of talent on that team, but something just seems fundamentally flawed. I don't know if it's the coaching or the personnel or what's going on, but they had that brief moment of brightness in a decade of dark. Wow, that was poetic. You know, they made the playoffs, right? They went 11-5 or something. Sandwiched that with some more stinker seasons, but you know, I don't know if Reggie Bush is the piece that helps them make any sort of jump, especially in a very tough division.
Well, you make the point, and I listened to a podcast with Todd McShay and Mel Kiper, And Tommy Shea made a good point. And when you look at the drafts that the Lions have had over the past 5-6 years, you know, when the drafts come out, they consistently get B+, A-, B grades, just based on the players that come out and sort of the way that they hypothetically would fit in the system. But it turns out years later, you know, they've had a couple bright spots making the playoffs, but, you know, years like last year when they had Calvin, you know, do his thing, but the team just didn't do that well. You know, they haven't really seen the success that you would expect of a team that's had, you know, pretty good drafts on paper. So, you know, you make a good point in saying that, you know, these guys, they do have talent but don't develop the way they're supposed to. And even like this move with Reggie Bush right now, I feel like that's not what the team needs, like specifically right now. A guy that I don't think is going to have a huge amount of success, you know, running the ball, especially, you know, that division, the defenses that they have. But, you know, like you said, that's a good point about just trying to figure out what's wrong with the Lions. But, you know, I'm in agreement that Reggie Bush was not the way to go.
Yeah. It's so funny that looking back on that draft, because it was one of the more hyped NFL drafts that I can remember, and it had some of the best college players really of all time, and especially taking into account the fact that Reggie Bush and Vince Young played against each other in that epic Rose Bowl. Mario Williams, obviously more under the radar, and the guy who everyone, you know, slammed the Texans for taking him first overall, it looked for a while there like he was going to be the best of all of them, but he's kind of fallen off too. It's kind of three really promising players that have had varying levels of success. I mean, Vince Young was a playoff quarterback for a while, and Bush is a good complimentary piece, but he doesn't seem like he's part of a winning NFL team. He doesn't seem like he fits somewhere on a winning team. Now, maybe there's some style that could use him, like if he was on the Saints today. I'm not sure. But let's talk about the Falcons a little bit before we get to some baseball stuff, because we haven't had an occasion to talk about the Falcons so far. They've been quiet in free agency, but they've been focused on their own guys, which is also good. And the biggest news is obviously that Tony Gonzalez is returning, and he announced it via Twitter. Everybody has gone wild. I'm not in Atlanta, but I can hear the din from here. It keeps Atlanta right in the thick of title contenders in the NFC. I think if he's gone, the offense takes a step back, perhaps, losing him and Turner. But him back is huge. The other thing it does is allow us to spend a first-round pick on a defensive player. We won't have to take a tight end first round. We still might draft one, but Carson, did you weep tears of joy or merely stomp your feet and holler at the wind when you heard the news?
I screamed. I cried. I think Tony coming back helps us just in so many ways. I think it's a nice little Band-Aid, especially for the position that we need moving forward. And, you know, like you said, you know, he brings much more to our team. I think that our team's going to be right back in the spot that we were last year, competing to go to the Super Bowl and eventually win one with Tony at the helm. Not only does he bring offense production, and he's a good blocker, but in terms of personnel moves in the offseason, you know, we have another year to figure out who's going to be the heir apparent to Tony Gonzalez, and allows us to focus on some other holes that we have to fill in the offseason and in the draft. So we talked about it a little bit a couple weeks ago, and I thought that was going to be a big factor in our front office's decision to make certain moves, you know, either right now and you know, during the free agents period or, you know, in April during the draft. So him coming back is just remarkable. I think that we're going to have a great shot next year. You know, didn't show any signs of rush, you know, last year at that tight end position, I think, especially the way that he plays it. You know, he's big and strong, and he's going to get positioned on guys and make plays. He's not really necessarily asked to stretch the field, you know, and he's not going to run down the field, you know, 40 yards of play and outrun people, but he's going to catch those 7-yard hitches you know, catch passes over the middle that extend drives. But, you know, he's just going to be Tony, and we're happy to have him back.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I did mention that about the draft, specifically our first-round pick, but I still think we might look to draft a tight end at some point because it still would be very beneficial for the heir apparent to have a year learning under Tony. Why not? And I wonder who they would target maybe in the second or third round if there's kind of a promising guy who's a bit more of a project, not as much of a sure thing, to step in and learn from the greatest tight end of all time. I'm just going to say it. Try to debate me on it, but I will defeat you because it's Tony. It's Tony, yeah. Man. It's just him. And the offense. Okay, so how about this? What's a better threesome? Julio, Roddy, and Tony, or Welker, Bebe, and Mr. Decker?
And I was going to pose that question earlier, you know, when I came out, that made me start thinking about, you know, other good triplets, tandems in the league. That's tough, really, just because that system makes those three so dangerous. And I think that just so you look at things right now, you know, Bebe is the younger guy. I mean, Decker's young too. You know, a lot younger than Welker. Those two are definitely great deep threats. I don't know, Ace. I'm going to go with the home team every time. But I just think that system, they might put up better stats. I mean, more proficient just because they throw the ball so much. But I think from the team that we have and the style of play that we, you know, I feel we're more of a balanced team, even though we're moving towards passing the ball more. You know, I can't go against Julio. You can't.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, if you want to, like, compare kind of their roles on the team, you know, Julio and Demaryius are, you know, the real true, although, you know, both teams have multiple home run threats. Those are the real home run threats. And that's kind of a push to me, if not giving the advantage to Julio. You know, they're both just specimens and incredibly strong. I think maybe Julio has more ball skills because he has as many ball skills as anybody in the league almost. But, you know, so compare them and then the guys who work in the center of the field, Tony and Welker, still feels like you got to give the edge to the Hall of Famer there. And then, obviously, Roddy has the edge over Decker. So, I don't know. I mean, that's not really how you break it down on a football field. It's not a bunch of one-on-ones, but it seems like the Falcons have an edge to me. But those two teams, I think, definitely head and shoulders over. I'm trying to think of anyone else in the league who's got three that could hang with that. I don't think.
Yeah, it's definitely impressive, especially if you think about the way that Julio, you know, left the season. The last game, he's just absolutely dominant. You know, in the losing effort, but you know, yeah, I'm really excited to see what he does in his third year, first year, you know, as a Pro Bowl player. Like you said, you know, you can't go wrong with either of those triplets. And Asa, you know, you make a good point about drafting a tight end at some point. And you know, I've seen a number of mock drafts, and I think that we're going to have to address the edge rusher issue at some point. Not saying that we can draft a rookie to come in and just fill, you know, Abraham's shoes, a guy that had some pretty productive years for us in the past. And you also look at running back. You know, after we lost Michael Turner, you know, is Jaquizz Rodgers, you know, going to be the answer at running back, a guy that can carry the ball, you know, 30 times a game and produce the numbers and sort of production that Turner had, you know, in the same capacity. So I've seen a couple of drafts, you know, we have us picking at 30 this year. I've seen a couple having us taking defensive ends, either, you know, Tate Carradine, a guy that had a great year at Florida State before blowing out his knee last week of the season, scheduled to be back healthy, you know, by training camp. I've also seen an interesting mock draft having us taking Eddie Lacy.
Back
out of Alabama, yet with that 30th pick, which I think would be phenomenal. for us. But like I said, it depends a lot on the offseason moves just in free agency. I think both of those have to be addressed. And I think that if we're going to draft a rookie at one of them, I feel like running back would be that position because we know they can make an immediate impact. I can't expect a rookie to come and take over a defensive end playing, you know, three downs a series at that position.
Yeah.
And when you look at the tight end, one quick thing, at the tight end position, a guy that sort of jumped out of people's boards this past couple of weeks is a guy named Dalvin Escobar. It's a being Hispanic last name at tight end. I think we should fit us nicely.
Where is he from? I mean,
he's from San Diego State. And, you know, his tape, he looks, you know, fluid. He catches the ball with his hands. The thing is that system is very wide open, and he caught a lot of balls, and I think he was mainly used as a receiver, whereas Tony sort of does both. So it would be interesting to see if we would take a guy like that and hopefully.
What are his measurables?
He's 6'5", and I want to say he's around 255. He's a big boy,
yeah.
Without a doubt. But
nobody likes to dream about that.
Yeah, seriously, he's just not. He wasn't asked to do as much blocking as I think. We asked Tony to do, but
yeah.
he would definitely be a nice fit, I think. Just have to see how we could bring him along.
Speaking of blocking, you gave me a perfect segue. The Falcons locked up tackle Sam Baker, who at one point in his career could have been described as either embattled or much maligned. However, at this juncture in his career, the only way to describe him is paid. And the Falcons rewarded Sam Baker. They stuck with him at left tackle. He was a guy who they took at the end of the first round. You've said it before on the show. He wasn't a guy who was ever considered a guy with a lot of upside. Probably wasn't supposed to stick at left tackle. The Falcons kind of took a chance, maybe a safe pick. But he really has honed his game after getting benched two years ago, and then last year put together a really incredible season. According to one ranking I looked at, he was the fifth best left tackle in the league, I think, in terms of protecting the quarterback. And he gets $41 million over 6 years, the $10 million signing bonus, and then he's really not making much year per year. So when you think of it that way, as money against the cap, it's not bad. This coming season, he'll make only $1 million, and it goes up to 3, 4, 5, and then 6, but that's not till 2017. So very smart move here. They also re-signed Garrett Reynolds, I believe, so solidifying that line, you know, so they just have more time to gel, and, you know, the whole offense has continuity, because that's important down to every position. From the skill positions to the first baseman, you got to have, lineman. How did you feel about playing one of the positions that was not considered a, quote, skill position? Were you ever rankled by that description?
I wasn't ever, you know, too offended by it. I mean, I wasn't a skillful player, you know, so.
Obviously.
It wasn't the biggest deal, but, you know, to each their own, and everyone has a purpose, everyone's position has been, it's unimportant. So, the skill name on the face is kind of hurtful when you think about it, but, you know, yeah. we may do.
Yeah. Well, you can just think of a better name for the lineman, because it's not, you know, then you can figure that out. I'm going to put on a tune for the people to listen to, because I have to take a quick moment to peek outside the door and make sure that's not the postman. I'm going to take a quick music break. This has been Foul Territory on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Right back.
I be on it all night, man. I be on it all day. Straight up. If you want me, you can find me in the air. That's just the way it goes. I be on that shit that I had you on that I don't want no more. At this time I need all my free show to get down on the floor. If you came to rep your set right now,
get what's down from the head of the sleep. Damn it, I don't think I'll be out in the week. Straight heat swerving down them streets. In the stolen blind of building 23s on the feet. The legend Rocky D. Brown. Back in time to beat it down. Give me face, I love the sound. Slap the taste, they hit the ground. Back in the 8, flick the pick up with some P.I. That don't blink. On that kryptonite we stay. So how we might fly away.
I'll be on that kryptonite. Straight up on that kryptonite.
Man, I be on it all day. Straight up pimp. If you want me, you can find me in the air. I'm on it, 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 I'm
on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it, I'm on it,
Italy's still leading. They're up 3-1.
Wow.
This Puerto Rico offense has been putrid in the tournament. They were the lowest scoring team to advance to the second round. They lost last night to the U.S., putting up just one run, and tonight, in the elimination game, they've mustered just one against the Italians, and it came on an error. Really poor showing, not a lot of power. Angel Pagan has been on base every single time, but the middle of that lineup is not producing. And the Italians, they might get another chance to survive if they can hold on here. They got a 2-run lead at the top of the 8, the Italians batting, so two more cracks at it for Puerto Rico to get 2 runs.
Yeah, Ace, that should be, like you said, that'd be a huge one for Italy, and definitely shaking some things up in the tourney.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. They showed what happened when Puerto Rico scored the run. And just before the play, I think the half inning before, they had been in the stands talking to a father of one of the players on the Italian team, and it happened to be the shortstop, and he got a hit while they were interviewing him, and the dad got really excited. But then in the next inning, it was the same kid who had 2 errors, one of them giving up the run.
I think one of them
plating the run, which had gotten on base through his first error, and then they, of course, in true TV fashion, cut right to the dad who has a pained, horrified look on his face, or he wants to just choke a tiny little kitten or something.
That is unfortunate.
But still in the lead, so he's not Bill Buckner yet. But you guys look out for the U.S. and the Dominican tomorrow, I believe. I think I'm only going to get the first half of that game, but I'm still excited, and even if the U.S. loses, they're not out of it. Then they'll just have to play Italy if Italy gets through here before getting another crack at the Dominican. Double elimination's kind of weird, but you got to do it in baseball because it's not football. It's not a one-off sport. And speaking of not one-off, we're going to do the final installment of Ace's Super Fantastic Fantasy Baseball Preview 2013 Fantastico. And it's not one off because this is the 1, 2, 3, 4th installment. Started off, we're going to do it division by division. And then I realized that was a little too sparse. So we combined the Centrals. And today we're going to combine the West. Although, as I teased last week at the top, the Central is definitely less loaded than both the East and the West, and that's for both the American League and the National League, even though the loaded Astros left the NL Central. But the West has a lot of talent, and the Giants have won the World Series 2 out of the last 3 years. The Rangers went there 2 years in a row. The Angels obviously are souping up. Meanwhile, the AL East has weakened a little bit, so a bit of a power shift, a bit of a paradigm shift, if you will. So we're going to go through the positions like we've been doing in Ace of Beals' Fantastic Fantasy Preview with all those other words in the title. And we're going to start with starting pitchers because they're on the hill. They're hurling the ball. And some of the best are in the West. I'm talking about Clayton Kershaw and Felix Hernandez. So the real question, as you sit there, let's say you are in the middle of the draft. You're doing a snake draft, 12-team league, and you decide you want to get a pitcher in one of the first two rounds. So it gets your first pick, still too early to take a pitcher, so you take some studly hitter. Say you get Matt Kemp. Then it's coming back around, Justin Verlander's off the board, and you want to take a starting pitcher with that middle second round pick, and Kershaw and Felix are left. Who do you take? To me, that is a very, very difficult question. And for the benefit of the listener to Foul Territory, sponsored by BackSportsPage.com, I've thought about this for hours on end. I've covered it. I've made pro-con charts. I've made pie charts and cake charts and tart charts. And I think I have an answer, but I still don't know. To me, these are two of the best three starters in the entire Major League Baseball, and therefore the world. It pains me, but I think Kershaw, for fantasy purposes, is the better option. I know you're going to hate me for that, and I do love Felix, but my brain tells me I have to say that.
When you pose that matchup or that conflict, you know, it is difficult to choose between the two, but I feel like when you have two guys that are so close in talent and output and production, don't you have to sort of look at the offense they have behind them?
Exactly.
So I think LA, you know, could help them squeeze out some more wins. Felix has pitched phenomenally on not great teams, but I just feel like LA is a better team, especially going into the season than the Mariners.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. That was like we just connected there through the ether web with more than just our words, ladies and gentlemen, because that's exactly what I was alluding to. And I think if it was which pitcher would I take for one game for my team to win that one game, I think I take Felix. But in fantasy baseball, one of the five categories happens to be wins, and sadly wins are largely based on the team around you, not always something within the starting pitcher's control. And Kershaw does have a loaded offense around him. The Dodgers have improved so much, and even if half those guys don't come close to what they were before all of their recent struggles, they still have a very good team, and they're just loaded every position. I mean, they have a relative newcomer in Luis Cruz that we'll get to in the third base section, but even he had a very good stint last year as their starting third baseman. So, yeah, to me, in the starting pitchers out West, it's got to be Kershaw and Felix, 1A and 1B, respectively. But, you know, you can't go wrong either way. They both get tons of strikeouts. They both are going to pitch a lot of innings, which – and ERA is great. Great rate stats like ERA and WHIP are great, but they're even better when the guy goes deep because then they count for more because he's a higher percentage of your innings. So you always want that starting pitcher that can go out and give you 8 or 9 innings. And really, that's the only time that Felix knows he can win is if he gets a 2-run lead. He's like, okay, I'm going 9. Not letting this happen. So those two guys are both elite. They're both second-round picks. You could jump up into the first if you really want a starting pitcher. I wouldn't recommend it strategically, but both guys are just incredible. They're on my all-universe rotation, sliding in at number 2 and 3. The next group is what a lot of people would still consider elite, and I think Matt Cain still holds the title of the front runner of that group. He's close to being in the top group. To me, is kind of lost a half step. Doesn't have the same level of dominance as Kershaw and Felix, though he still is incredibly consistent and still gets a lot of strikeouts. But Kane, Zach Greinke, and Jared Weaver fill out, and a still great, if not elite, group. And Greinke is joining that Dodgers squad as well, so that bodes well for his win totals. He'll finally be in a stable situation, ideally, with that long-term contract. He's been bounced around a lot, traded these last few years. Jared Weaver, a guy who I'm not too high on, but he's talented. I don't know. This is a group that these are guys that will probably get reached for, to be honest. And I'm not going to be the one to reach for these guys. If Greinke's still around, you know, in the fourth round, I'll take him. But I'm not sure if he'll be there then. What about your boy, Yu Darvish? What are your expectations for him coming into the game, into the year, for the whirling Darvishes of Parson Phillips Fong?
I mean, Yu is my guy. You know, I went on the limb picking him somewhat early. I got him in the fourth round last year. Definitely surprised pleasantly about the production he offered. And, you know, he started the season off stronger than he ended it. But I'm still keeping him regardless. I'm just really pumped about, you know, what he has to offer and what he can do moving forward. Not looking forward too much for a sophomore slump, but when you look, Asa, at his ERA, 3.9, which is not the best in the world, but, you know, he still had 16 wins. And that's, I think, has a lot to do with sort of that division that he plays in and also the team he has behind him. So a lot of times, you know, you might be able to give up 4 or 5 runs, still get the win. You can make some mistakes early, which he did a lot. I know a lot of the games he played in, he would go down, you know, 3-0, 2-0 in the first couple of innings and then calm down and pitch a great game and come out with the win, give his team a chance to come back. To the ERA, like you said, you're not going to like that, but on a playoff team with some good bats and, you know, known for its offensive prowess, I'm definitely excited to see him grow and adjust in the system.
Yeah, and I think that ERA should come down. I'm inclined to think he was a little unlucky. He does walk a lot of guys. He walked 4.2 per 9 innings, which was 89 on the season, which is, it's a pretty high number anytime you're that close to 100. He compensates for that by striking out a ton of guys to the tune of 221 in his rookie year. I mean, that's K's on deck. And like we said, that's one of the 5 main categories. So you always want to target strikeout guys over non-strikeout guys in fantasy, if, you know, all things being equal. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. But Darvish, I mean, in another year, could have been the rookie of the year in the AL. You know, nobody else was going to get it besides Trout. But guys like Darvish and Cespedes, even in that same division, both could have won it, even though not really rookies. But one point about that is Yu Darvish obviously isn't really a rookie because he is a veteran of the Japanese League, which doesn't have the same standards quite in terms of the talent as Major League Baseball, but still a very highly regarded association. And he was the best pitcher over there. I don't think he had the same walk problems there that he has here or has had so far. And I think that's kind of easy to explain. Maybe I'm taking the obvious kind of logical path here, but, you know, coming over here, he knows the hitting is going to be better. He knows there's more power. He knows if you leave a mistake in the middle of the plate, it's not just going to get slapped to left field for a double. It's going to get crushed. And he probably came in giving U.S. hitters a little, maybe even more respect than they deserve by hemming and hawing a bit, not going right at them, because he's got the pure stuff. Maybe he wasn't as confident in it blowing away hitters as when he pitched in Japan, but he should have every confidence. And I think you'll see that ERA come down to the mid-3s, which isn't great, but it's a really nice second or third tier pitcher, especially with those strikeouts, and probably a second tier pitcher, especially with the wins likely going up a little bit. They get in a couple extra games against the Astros. Maybe he gets 2 or 3 starts against the Astros. Hey, who knows? That's 3 wins right there. So, you know, he's a guy I wouldn't be shocked to see get close to 20 wins, 18, 20 wins. That, you know, he's had a very, very solid first year. And I just want to point out that his full name is Sefat Farid U. Darvish.
Yeah,
it sounds a lot different that way, doesn't it? I know he's half Iranian, and he definitely
has
the Japanese side of things.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's conscious for his American image. Seriously, I mean,
it might well be. I think, you know, it could be easier to get behind the guy. With the name U. Darvish, but we'll see. That's neither here nor there.
Hussein Darvish. No, Hussein is a great name. That's our president's middle name.
It is.
Yeah, I'm not gonna agonize over every single starting pitcher. So let's talk about some of the sexier names who already maybe made a splash, but who might be making more of a splash. The first one that comes to mind is young Daniel Straley, or I think he goes by Dan Straley of the Oakland Athletics. And last year we got real excited about them, talking about them down the stretch as they cruised up the standings and grabbed the AL West Division crown right out of the hands of the Rangers at the last gasp. And Straley was a big part of that, not a huge part of that. He only threw 40 innings, but those were very solid innings, went only 2-1, 3.89 ERA, but really showed some flashes. He gave up a lot of home runs and didn't have great command, but was striking guys out and looked very poised. And I like him to take a step forward this year. Look out for Dan Straley. Definitely a sleeper in my book. And another one is Bud Norris. Yes, he's a pitcher for the Astros, but in my opinion, that actually helps his value. You're saying, what? Asa, what are you talking about? Last week, you told us to bet against the Astros because they're going to be one of the worst teams in MLB history. And I say to that, exactly, because guess what? Bud Norris is going to get traded. It might not be today or tomorrow, but it'll certainly be at some point during the season. The Astros have gotten rid of pretty much every asset that's even close to free agency in their entire team. They've restocked. They need a major, major, major organizational overhaul. And Bud Norris is just wasted value on a team like that. So they're going to flip him probably to at least a decent team. And I like his talents. He's got real strikeout abilities. And if he gets put on a decent team, you know, joins the rotation as a fourth or a fifth starter, gets some run support, he could be a solid fantasy option. So he's kind of a little bit of a backdoor sneaky sleeper there.
Yeah, based on the things you're saying, that's definitely one way to consider picking up an Astro.
Yeah, it's one way. So let's get to the position players. And within the position players is only a few Astros that I would consider taking. There's no Astros pitchers outside of Norris that I would consider, and only for that reason that I said that he likely will get traded. But catcher is a little bit powerhouse in these divisions, at least. Overall, it's a very weak fantasy position. But Buster Posey is a guy who's going to go really high. Definitely, I assume he'll be a second rounder at this point. He's proved that he's all the way back from that horrific injury. He's going to hit for a .320 average. He's just that good, and he's going to have power. Maybe not 30 home runs, but probably 25. And they're going to play him at first base enough that he can stay healthy and stay fresh throughout the year. I'm not going to be the one who reaches for a catcher. But you know what, Carson? I just rue every day that Buster Posey had to go to Florida State, because you know the Braves scout all of the Georgia talent and draft Georgia talent and sign Georgia talent so well. They take care of home. And Buster is a Georgia boy. But he had to go to Florida State and be one of the best college catchers, so he shot up the board. If he had just come out of damn high school in the draft, he could be an Atlanta Brave.
And that is kind of crazy when you look at it like that. I mean, you know, you see guys, I've gone to a couple games at the TED, and you see folks wearing his Florida State jersey, you know, here in Atlanta. You know, like you said, he's a Georgia boy, and we respect him for that, but it's so tough having to see him play for another organization. And, you know, I was watching a program on MLB Network, and an analyst talked about, You know, he thinks that if he stays healthy, he can be, you know, a Derek Jeter type guy, a guy that's just very consistent in his play year in and year out, a guy that brings leadership to his team and, you know, a good player to boot. So definitely some high praises coming for young Buster as he sort of gets over the injury and moves on the next stage of his career.
Yeah, that's true. And I got to hear all about him out here in San Francisco. And right
from sure.
The league MVP and has really been the pivotal player in two World Series runs. Just incredible. But the catcher that I'm excited about out west is young Willian Rosario out of the Dominican Republic. He's 24 years old, which is criminal. I just turned 24. He is just like 2 weeks older than me. And this dude can mash. He had only 396 at-bats last year. Let's call it 400. A typical season, usually you expect about 500 at-bats. Maybe not that many for a catcher, but close to that. He hit 28 bombs. He quietly hit 28 home runs last year and hit 270. So it's not as if he's only power. He's got some contact skills, didn't walk a lot, but he managed to put in 71 RBIs, scored 67 runs. I mean, at the catcher position, that is incredible. And you're saying, well, you know, isn't this a fluke? Has he ever done it before? And no, I mean, this is really his first full season. But there's every reason to expect he will continue. And why? Because he plays for the Rockies. And in fantasy, Rockies are gold. I wouldn't want to be running that team because it's just so hard to build a winning club there to convince good pitchers to go there. But for fantasy, it's incredible. And him getting to play 81 games in the Mile High Stadium, although it's not called that anymore, is a huge advantage, a huge advantage. And I also just want to point out that his nickname is Baby Bull. He's only 5'11". So, you know, if that doesn't convince you to draft him, I don't know what will, and you'll just be the idiot that passed on him. So there's some knowledge from foul territory.
There it is. You don't want to be the idiot known to pass on Baby Bull. So
Baby Bull. Made me think of Sitting Bull. But that's a Native American. Not a Native American, but an American by immigration is the one who leads the first base class. And I'm, of course, talking about the best player of the last decade, who everyone seems to have forgotten about, Albert Pujols. Oh, yeah, that guy who was the best player in baseball for, like, 8 years in a row. He hasn't gone anywhere. He had a little bit of a down year, but I expect him to be back stronger than ever, especially with Josh Hamilton batting directly behind him in that lineup, Trout on base in front of him. He's the machine, and he's King Albert, and he's everything you ever dreamed of in a baseball player. And I like him to get back to at least close to the levels of a couple of years ago. And I think he's back to being a high first round pick.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, I picked him last year with the first overall, and you know, I was tormented daily by the reports on ESPN about how he can't hit home runs or that, you know, the foolish countdown they had, you know, until he hit his first home run. But, you know, then after he hit it and he sort of got into the swing of things, you know, it was all forgotten. And he ended up putting up a year that was pretty comparable to the years he put up in the past, in terms of his power numbers at least. And like you said, Asa, with those additions that they've made, in Anaheim, I think that just bodes well for him, with more protection in the lineup and more opportunities to drive in guys and make plays with the bat.
Yeah, I mean, he's so incredible, and he's one of those hitters who, you know, we can sit here all day and look at everybody's player page and compare their home run totals and their RBI totals and their OPS plus, but Pujols is the guy who you watch play, and it all makes sense. You know, when you can watch him for one game, for one at bat, and you're like, okay, this is definitely a three-time MVP. This is definitely a guy who's a 325 lifetime hitter, in addition to having 475 home runs already at the age of 33. I mean, good Christ in heaven above. He should have more MVPs if it wasn't for that dirty, stinking cheat, Barry Bonds. What up, San Francisco? This guy is absolutely incredible. And you're right. There's been a small decline, and there's a chance that he's older than he is on record, because Dominican Republic is notorious for having spotty birth records, and that's something to acknowledge. He's 33, according to the internet, but maybe he's 35, which, you know, while he's in incredible shape and just physically one of the most gifted players, if you're 35, that there's going to be some decline. And last year, he still hit 285, and he still got to 30 home runs for, 12th time in a row to start his career. So, and he also hit 50 doubles. So maybe the ball just wasn't flying for him like he expected it to, but there's plenty of parks out in the West for him to hit a lot of home runs in. I mean, add Houston to there, that place, you can hit bombs to left in that short porch, as he did once upon a time to crush the hopes and dreams of the Astros. So, yeah, I see him getting back to his old wily ways. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the decline has started in earnest.
Well, let's hope not, because I'm investing, yet again, another first-round pick in him this year. So,
are you going to keep Pujols?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I mean, the draft order will be determined, I guess, soon enough. But just don't see, after every team keeps 3 to 5 guys, who I could get that would be better than him with the first overall pick.
Yeah. No, that's true. It's funny how keepers work. And for any fantasy noobs out there, you'll want to listen up, because this is golden advice if you're looking to join a league that's a little more ambitious than just your basic 5x5. But keepers, it works like the free market, you know? Yeah, there's just a bunch of moving pieces, and you're balancing your own concerns with that of everyone else, and you're trying to determine what you want to do. But it's not only based on you, it's based on what everyone else is willing to do, and just the price, in essence, of a certain player, even though in our league it's a straight keep. It's not, there's no dollar values, but, you know, the round essentially is the price tag on him. And you're right about Pujols, because you were so viciously beaten by me 9-1 in the finale last year's season. I believe that means you have the second to last pick, or is it random draft order? I think, isn't it based on?
The commission has spoken, and it's going to be randomized.
Oh, okay.
This year, so I mean, it'll give me a better shot to get towards the top. But I mean, I just feel that so with the production that I've gotten from him, and you know, expecting him to get better, I'll keep him. And it's like you said, with the draft values, especially, I think this league's in his third year, it really weighs a lot in trades, you know, the sort of like expiring contracts that you might want to dump. A lot of times, you know, you might take a little bit worse of a trade to get someone that can help you for, you know, at least a certain amount of time, if you know that there's a guy that you're just not going to keep with that value. So I think it definitely adds a nice little aspect to the game. Maybe it makes you think about how you want to move forward and the guys you have on your team.
Yeah, I'm kind of coming up against it. I have so many guys that I want to keep, because I have certain really good deals, but then certain guys that are kind of top players, just at not a steal, but just a good value. And like Prince Fielder in the third round, I kind of want to keep him, but I had other guys in mind. So we need to start the trade activity. I don't know how much people.
We definitely do.
Because, and I think we talked about this before, but I'm pretty sure we have to do the draft order before we do keepers, because that has a big influence on keepers. Unless we want to just do it blind.
I know that the keepers are you have to submit your keepers to the commission, by the 20th, so a week from today. So I'm not completely sure about when the draft order is coming, but I think that makes sense. I mean, because like you said, it's going to change the value of players, you know, significantly if you have the first overall pick or if you have the 12th pick, whatever you might have, in terms of if there's a guy that you're sort of looking at keeping.
Yeah, we have some news to report, you all. We just have 5 minutes left in foul territory. Obviously, we're not going to get to every position, but Puerto Rico, like the plucky little island that they are storming back. They've come within a run of the Italians. They now have runners at first and third after Alex Rios dumped a little humpback liner into right field. I think that was Gregor Blanco who was pinch running, who got all the way around. Oh, no, he's Venezuelan. That wasn't him. It really looked like him. Look at that on the Puerto Rican team. I thought it was Gregor, but the Puerto Ricans now have runners at first and third, and Italy is on the verge of coughing up the lead. Oh,
wow.
Dio mio.
Wow.
But I hope they hold on. I do. Let's talk about, we don't have much time left. Let's talk about outfielders. Screw all those infield positions. They're not as exciting. Sorry. The outfielders are where the marquee talent is in the West. And obviously, the top of the outfield, you have to start with the man, Mike Trout. Now, the real question, the only question to ask with Mike Trout, because obviously you want him on your team, the only question you have to ask yourself is, if you have the first pick, are you taking Miguel Cabrera or Mike Trout? We already had the debate about Miguel Cabrera or Mike Trout for AL MVP. Philosophically, we already had the debate of Miguel Cabrera versus Mike Trout for best player on the planet Earth. So in fantasy, who's the better one? And that depends a lot on your confidence in Trout being able to reproduce what he did last season. I think if he does over the course of a full season, he's more valuable than Cabrera because he provides five categories. He can help win you stolen bases. But at this point, I think I would still take Cabrera higher. He has that third base eligibility, which helps. It makes him a little more valuable than if he was still a first baseman. And he just has the track record, and it just has been an absolute. I mean, he's been more of a machine than Pujols the last 5 years. And as Pujols experienced his slight decline, Miggy has really ascended as the best hitter on the planet. And I think I still take Miggy over Mike Trout, but it's tough. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you said, it was a huge debate last year in terms of the MVP voting and sort of how guys are going to sort of look at the comparison between the two. And like you said, Asa, I think, you know, either one of those guys are going to do great things for your team. And like you said, it's going to have to be based on, I think, a lot of times, sort of how you want to build your team and other guys you might have your mind on. Because you said, you know, Trout can help you win a wide array of categories. But like you said, Miggy is on the incline. And he's really been doing some great things. You know, winning the batting title last year. So, you know, in those, you know, big offensive categories, he's going to be present. He's going to be, you know, at the top of the league. But like you said, I mean, I'd probably go with Miggy as well, just like you said, because of the trend of him moving up. I have to pick that above the upside of, you know, of Trout just blowing the top of the league.
Yeah, it's astronomical. I'm not convinced that he's going to hit 30 home runs every year. I know he could, but he is going to be their leadoff hitter because both Pujols and Hamilton are locked in long-term. It's not as if he's going to be moved into a run-producing role. So I just don't know if he's going to be able to always be hitting that for that much power because I just feel like he's going to be focusing more on getting on base. But that's pure speculation. Maybe, you know, maybe he hasn't even shown us what he can do. Maybe the rookie season was just a taste. And then I'm way wrong because he hit 30 in only 4 or 5 months. And so then his ceiling is like 50-50 like Matt Kemp or something. But you know, I mean, get this guy if you can, and if you're in an auction, pay out the ass for him, because he will contribute in five categories. Runs, he's going to almost help, you know, he's going to like pretty much lock up runs for you if you're average across the board elsewhere, because he scores one every game. And so that's just an awesome boost, and he's going to contribute everywhere else, even RBIs as a leadoff hitter. I'd love him up there. But then, like we talked about, Colorado, man, Cargo is a guy who people question him overall as a player a little bit because of the Coors factor. But like we said, for fantasy, that's nothing but good news. He plays half his games up in the thin air, and he really has power, and he really can get on base. He's a beautiful, beautiful man to watch hit, and he's got that picturesque lefty stroke. He hits the ball out of the park, and it's with such ease. It's kind of like a young Beltran almost to me, maybe a little more violent even than Beltran, but that same smooth stroke, and he's going to get you steals too. I don't know if he'll get 30 anymore now that he's settling in, I believe, as a three hitter, but he still to me is a guy who should go really high, and maybe a guy who will fall a little bit because there's just not as much excitement around him or his team.
Yeah, it is true, and it's definitely something to look forward to. One of the big storylines moving into next year, and you know, excited to see how they grow and progress.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, that's about all I have the energy for. I believe we covered a lot of the positions. We didn't get to all of them, not as many as that famous Indian book. It was a badly chosen joke. But rest assured that the baseball is only just beginning, as the season hasn't even started off. We've already completed our fantasy preview, as we should, because you got to do that early, because drafts are going on nowsies, or in the next few weeks. And so we'll have more fantasy stuff coming up. We'll move to maybe the more theoretical side, talk about specific one-on-one draft battles, you know, would you take this guy over that guy, all that stuff. And,
I like it.
You know, then we'll get to previewing the season itself. We got the NFL draft coming up. So much good stuff to talk about. And maybe we'll do some specials for March Madness, have some guests who know a lot about college hoops to come on and help us out with that. So how's that sound, everybody? By the way, Puerto Rico just took the lead, 4-3.
Wow.
Bottom of the eighth. Italy's just falling apart.
I hate to see that happen, but PR would be, if they get the runs together, I think they might be a nice little pesky team to see in the next round. But the line of things to come on foul territory sound tantalizing indeed.
Tantalizing, my good sir, is the only word for it. And with that, we thank you. This has been Foul Territory on Blog Talk Radio, sponsored by Back Sports Page and SidelinesApp.com every single Wednesday here on Blog Talk Radio at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We could go for 2 hours. We could go for three. We have to cut ourselves off because we have to eat. Anyway, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll hear from you and talk to you next week.
Soldier Boy, tough. Hey, I got the new dance for y'all called the Soldier Boy. You just gotta punch, then crank back three times from left to right. Why me crank it? Why me roll? Why me crank that Soldier Boy? That Superman? That hoe? Now why me? You.